Your Health is supported by the North Carolina Cancer Hospital, serving you with innovative research with unequaled care. UNC Healthcare is leading, teaching, caring.
News Talk 1360, WCHL, and UNC Family Medicine present Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Your Health, providing practical health-related news and information for our listeners. Dr. Goldstein and Dr. Page are both actively involved in patient care at UNC Family Medicine. Now, Your Health.
Welcome to UNC Family Medicine's Your Health, supported by UNC Healthcare. I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein.
And Adam, on our show today, we will be talking with the director of the North Carolina Translational and Clinical Sciences, Dr. Marshall Runge, about translating science into better human health. This will be an important conversation.
Oh, yeah. This is a huge project. It's happening across the United States, and there's a large research center at UNC. So I think this promises to be interesting for us and for our listeners. And speaking of translating science into better human health, Christy, you know, I hope our listeners have gone to yourhealthradio.org recently, and they've seen some new features that we're actually promoting on our Your Health radio site, including book reviews now. A lot of our guests have done some books, and we're putting up book reviews.
And you can find information about our house calls and also about research that matters. And we've got some good research that matters today, Adam.
Yep. We're going to talk about MSG and weight gain.
About fish oil in pregnancy and other vitamins trying to prevent pregnancy complications.
And then finally, particular type of therapy called CBT for those with irritable bowel syndrome. So lots of stuff. Let's talk about our very first research that matters.
Okay. This is about MSG, which is the food additive that you see a lot with Chinese food. And sometimes people say causes headaches after they eat Chinese food. That's been studied and in this case may be linked to weight gain.
Yeah, this article in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition, Christy, followed done by researchers actually at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, our colleagues here, looking at 10,000 adults in China for almost 6 years, following these people to see the amount of MSG they consume and its relationship to weight gain.
And they found that the men and women who ate the most MSG, so like 5 grams a day, were about...
Seems like a lot.
That's a lot. Were about 30% more likely to become overweight over that 5 to 6 year period than those who ate the least amount of that flavoring, like less than a half gram a day. Suggesting after they control... At first I thought, oh, well, they probably eat more junk chips and other things that have MSG, but I guess they controlled for multiple different factors to try to sort this out and concluded that it is linked with weight gain.
Yeah. And, you know, I guess I'm wondering, you know, how much MSG do adults in the United States regularly consume? And I'm sure it's probably less than maybe in China, but
That's a question that our smart librarians at the Health Sciences Library could look up for us and put a link on our...
How much MSG, is it an additive just in Chinese food or is it in other foods that we would normally be eating?
And how much do we average in America?
I know I routinely, when I go to Chinese restaurants, say I don't want MSG added in. But, you know, I think the question is it, you know, because I think about the headaches, but it sounds like they're, you know, what's the advantage of it other unless you just love the flavoring?
Well, I think the flavor is the main reason that it's put into our foods. But does it really have, you know, adverse effects? And in this case, it may be linked to weight gain, but I'm a little suspicious that there are likely other factors at play.
So a little diversity of opinion here, Christy and I, but some skepticism. On the other hand, I'm more likely when I go out to the restaurant to say, please give it to me without the MSG.
I'm not ready for that.
Okay. What's our very next research that matters?
Okay. This is about fish oil in pregnancy. So lots of people are taking fish oil and other vitamins in pregnancy to try to make their baby smarter or to try to boost their baby's vision.
Yeah. This is also an article that was in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition. Some really good research, where researchers from Australia looked at visual issues in 4-month-olds, almost 200, whose mothers had either taken fish oil capsules from the mid-pregnancy until the delivery, or a group who took placebo vegetable oil capsules.
And so this is what we're talking about with the fish oil, is this DHA, which is an omega-3 fatty acid involved in brain and visual development and very popular. But what they found was that really that supplement is not doing much to sharpen the baby's vision.
Yeah, and this actually builds upon research that came out last year that showed that fish oil during pregnancy did not boost babies' learning and language skills at the age of two. And so the question really is, should anyone be, without really strong risk factors, be taking this as a supplement during pregnancy? I mean, you deliver a lot of babies, Christy. How are you going to counsel women? What's the take on
message? Yeah, I do not recommend that my patients take fish oil. If they want to take it, we don't have, strong evidence to say it's harmful. But I don't recommend it. And the next one is also related about vitamins. People taking high doses of vitamin C and E to try to prevent preeclampsia.
Yeah, so this article in the American Journal of Obstetrics and Gynecology is one of these what we call these systematic meta-analyses where they combine studies. This particular one, 9 studies that included almost 20,000 pregnant women looking at all of the research of those who took extra vitamin C and E versus a placebo, and their risk of developing this preeclampsia, which is a very serious condition and a lot of morbidity, and people die from it if not treated. So if you could prevent it, it'd be a great thing.
It would. I've had it twice. Do not recommend it if you can prevent it. But in this case, high doses of vitamin C and vitamin E in the studies show that taking that made you no less likely to develop preeclampsia than if you were taking placebos. And in fact, the people who were taking these high doses were 10% more likely to get high blood pressure during pregnancy than the people in the placebo. So it may actually cause harm.
Yeah. And so again, a take-home message here is, sometimes maybe things that we think we're doing to improve health prove out upon real rigorous research not to have improvement. So in this particular case, there's really no evidence here that vitamin C and E supplements for pregnant women is something that they should take. But we do know one thing that pregnant women should take. What's that, Christy?
That is folic acid. There is good evidence for the benefits of folic acid to reduce spina bifida and other problems where the spinal cord doesn't develop properly. So you should take your prenatal vitamin because of the folic acid. And if you're at high risk for preeclampsia, you should talk to your doctor about potentially taking a baby aspirin to reduce that risk. But otherwise, it's just get good nutrition and take care of your body and don't drink alcohol and those sorts of things.
Well, let's talk about the last research that matters then, about something that you can do, a common condition, irritable bowel syndrome, and a new research in the American Journal of Gastroenterology that's not a drug, but that improves outcomes.
So this is about something called cognitive behavioral therapy. This is a form of counseling or therapy where a psychologist tries to help the way you think and about your behaviors and how you think about your body.
Yeah, I love this study, Christy. They 200 adults who had irritable bowel syndrome were given this cognitive behavioral therapy or a stress management program, both of which were actually given online over 10 weeks.
And by the end of the period, the majority of the patients in each group were having adequate relief from their pain and discomfort. But after 6 months, the people who had that cognitive behavioral therapy did a lot better. 65% said their symptoms were still under control, compared with 44% of those in the stress management group. So this is encouraging that you could do something online and that this cognitive therapy is helpful.
Right. And it helps people, really become to terms with their things that they're most fearful about. So a lot of people who have irritable bowel syndrome avoid so many foods because they think that all these foods make their symptoms worse. And this CBT, they actually allow them to have small amounts of many of these foods and then help them control and understand their symptoms so that they actually, what I like is that they become able to live what appears to be a more normal life and not
Absolutely.
So fearful of everything. And that fear seems to have a negative impact on irritable bowel disease.
Absolutely. It's also encouraging that it happened online and not you didn't have to pay or get transportation to go to the doctor. So we've talked a little bit about web behavioral therapy for irritable bowel symptoms.
that probably if you're pregnant, don't need to be taking fish oil, vitamin C, or vitamin E supplements.
And that MSG may be linked to weight gain. And if you're Adam, you might ask that it not be added to your food.
When you come out to eat with me, that's right. Well, that concludes the research that matters. We'll take a short break. And when we return, we'll be talking with Dr. Marshall Runge, director of the North Carolina Translational and Clinical Sciences Center, about translating science into better human health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Today on Conversations, we're going to be talking with the director of the North Carolina Translational and Clinical Sciences Institute and the executive dean for the UNC School of Medicine, Dr. Marshall Runge, about translating science into better human health, something that is critical and Christy and I are very excited about.
Thanks for being with us, Dr. Runge.
Thank you. Thank you both, Christy and Adam, for the opportunity to be here today and tell you a little bit about what I think is a terrifically exciting research support program that's in place here at UNC and has been in place for several years now.
So let's jump right in and talk about, we're going to talk about NCTRACS, which is the short way to say North Carolina Translational and Clinical Sciences Institute. But I want to jump right into what is translational research. I think for people who maybe don't know as much about research or aren't a part of the research community, it's hard to explain, and we're hoping you can translate translational research for us.
Well, I'll give it a try. So medical research, the broad term of medical research, encompasses everything from scientists who work in single cells or in bacteria or other organisms, all the way through physicians who enroll patients in late-stage clinical trials trying out the newest therapies that have been proven to be effective, but just to make sure they're effective and safe. What translational research encompasses is the middle part of that spectrum. So it really is the description of taking what looks like very promising discoveries made in a research laboratory, usually beyond studies that have been done in cells or even in experimental animals, but taking the most exciting discoveries made in a laboratory and then testing them further in models that as much as possible mimic human conditions, and then actually developing the trials and studies, the early studies in humans that will establish whether these are therapies that hold promise and if they look safe and seem to be doing the things that they are anticipated to do. Translational research is not the final test that would go to the FDA to establish that a new therapy is one that we should adopt and use in practice, but it's that middle ground. And so it's a very important part of research for use in patients. And the whole goal of these grants that support institutes like NCTRACS is to try to speed up that process. And traditionally, there's been one group of researchers who do the research in very basic studies and a separate group that do the clinical trials. And we're trying to bridge those by speeding up the most exciting discoveries and pushing them into clinical trials.
So is it more coordinating the people, these researchers in the two different ends, or is it more focusing on that one middle section to speed it up from a new discovery till it gets to a trial?
Well, it's both. And it's what the NCTRACS Institute does is to provide support. This is an institute that doesn't do its own research. It provides support for researchers, and it's supported all different levels. For example, if somebody has what looks like an exciting discovery, but they don't have a research grant to fund testing that in a small-scale human study, the NCTRACS Institute has a mechanism by which we give research grants to worthy projects, and we've given out about 300 research grants in the 3 years that the grant's been, almost 4 years that the grant's been up and going, and a total of $4 to $5 million in research grants to help support that. But we also provide a lot of times a a basic scientist may not know enough about biostatistics and how to statistically analyze their data from a clinical study standpoint, so we provide resources so that they can find a biostatistician who can help them with this. On the other far end, we have pilot grant programs to support what we call commercialization. So if there is a new therapy and it looks really promising, usually it's hard to get that from the point of a research study to an actual therapy, because pharmaceutical companies or device companies really aren't ready to take and fund that research. And so we also provide both research funding and an infrastructure for investigators who are very entrepreneurial and want to start their own company around their research. And we've done several of those. I'll give you one example. Dr. Lawrence Katz is a professor of emergency medicine here. He's long time studied this concept that if a person's body temperature, a person who's had a heart attack or had a severe injury, has their body temperature lowered, and then they're treated, that can better their outcome, can prevent brain injury, and in the case of somebody who's had a heart attack, lessen their risk of damage to their heart. So he's taken that research, which was done out of emergency rooms, and developed a company called Hibernade that develops pharmaceutical agents that lower the body's temperature. So that's a good example of something that was really sort of a clinical concept, but there wasn't anyone out there who was developing therapies that could be used in patients.
Dr. Runge, you know, this whole idea of developing work that can be made quicker into the patient population, I mean, that is a major goal, and to cut across. And UNC, and you're the director of this NC Tracks, and UNC is one of a couple dozen around the United States that are doing this. How is this really, I mean, is it really working? I mean, and how does the public know that it's working? Because I think this is a major question that you have to face as the director, to say that this is not only a great idea, but this idea itself is working.
Well, Adam, you really hit the crux of the issue here. And this was a new program that NIH started in about 2006 to try to fund these kinds of translational research institutes. And now, 5 years later, the leaders in NIH want to ask that same question: how do we know that these grants have delivered on their promise? Because it's time to refund those. And in fact, one of the things we'll be doing in the next year is writing a renewal application for our grant. So how do you know that? Well, that's a complicated question. The first challenge we've had is just making people aware that we have this kind of grant.
Mm-hmm.
And we've spent a lot of energy trying to do that. And that's why one of the reasons I was so delighted that you contacted me about the chance to speak on your show, because I know you have a terrific audience and a well-educated audience, and that this will be a good chance for us to reach out to people who may know nothing about this. And we do, a very important part of this program is not only translating research, but then disseminating the information about new therapies to the community. And we've had...
Can you give us an example of that, of something that maybe that you've done that you think has, and you know, has had some impact?
Yeah, let me give you a couple of examples. So one is, as you both know, a major issue is how we can best screen older individuals. I say this with a little bit of a tongue-in-cheek, since I'm over 50, well over 50, but individuals over 50 for the risk of colon cancer, particularly in rural communities where there are not either the financial resources or the physicians to perform colonoscopy. The standard of care today, of course, is that once you pass the age of 50, you ought to have a screening colonoscopy to be sure that you don't have precancerous lesions in your colon. In rural, and particularly eastern North Carolina, the resources to do that are not present. And a number of investigators from NC Tracks put together a research project in which they went to a rural community, worked with the local churches and the local civic associations to try to first increase awareness of colon cancer, and second, develop a simple screening approach. What they thought was a simple screening approach, which was testing for blood and stool, turned out that it was wasn't really written appropriately, and the individuals that were getting the screening didn't quite know how to deal with it. And so they learned from that and went back, and now in a community, and this is a small community in eastern North Carolina of about 2,000 people, up until then, the screening rate was less than 20%, and now the screening rate's up to about 60 or 70%. So that's had, I think, a real positive impact on the community. Another kind of interesting example, one I find very interesting, is Reverend Kearney from the Coley Springs Baptist Church in Warrenton came to us a year or so ago to ask for help in community farming and gardening. And the idea was, you might say, well, why is NC Tracts interested in farming and gardening? Well, their idea, and this was an idea from the community, and one of the things we try to do is seek out ideas from the community about what would make a difference in their lives. Their idea was that this would be one way to see if diet change reduces chronic diseases. And as you know, this is a big topic in the United States. The Obamas, for example, have been leading efforts to increase gardening and increase consumption of vegetables and unprocessed foods. So we worked with worked with Reverend Kearney and helped them obtain a $50,000 grant to build a one-acre garden. And today they're teaching members of their community how to garden and preserve their own crops. And we will follow this community and see if the diet change does indeed help reduce chronic diseases such as diabetes and obesity and osteoarthritis.
Well, that's great. You know, we're going to need to take a short break. I think when we come back, we'll want to pick up on this idea of examples of ways that you're having impact, where you need to go in the future to even have greater impact, and how you, again, communicate this not only to the public, but even to providers, because I think this is not necessarily intuitive that we all work together. But we're talking with Dr. Marshall Runge about translating science into better health. We'll be right back with Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page.
Your Health is supported by UNC Health Sciences Library and NC Health Info, working together to connect people everywhere with knowledge to improve health. Visit nchealthinfo.org for answers you can trust.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on WCHL. And now, back to the show.
Welcome back. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. We've been talking with the director of the North Carolina Translational and Clinical Sciences Institute, or NC Tracts, Dr. Marshall Runge, about translating science into better human health. And Dr. Runge, you were talking a little bit about some examples of real success stories of your program getting into communities. And I think what was remarkable about that to me is just the importance of using the way that you're approaching churches and community members and really investing in the stakeholders of the people that you're trying to affect to improve health. What do we know about the benefits of including the community in this research?
Christy, that's a great question. And partly it's a hypothesis, the hypothesis being that if we establish ongoing and direct and great communication with communities and community leaders who represent their communities, that'll help us focus research in the right direction, and I think that's right. So to try to do that, we've done several things. First, and I really need to give tremendous credit to a group called our Community Engagement Corps that's directed by Dr. Giselle Corby-Smith. They have established ties throughout North Carolina, but principally in central North Carolina, in Greensboro and Winston-Salem and other communities, with a variety of community leaders who represent all different demographics. Particularly, though, we've tried to reach out to those lower socioeconomic groups who may not have access to health care in the same way that some of the rest of us have access to health care, and to try to find out what can we do and how can we help them to improve their health. That has one of the outcomes of that is we have an external advisory board that has representatives from a vast array of of individuals across the state, and again, focused in Central North Carolina. And they've come up with some very good ideas. So I just told you about the gardening from Reverend Kearney.
Mm-hmm.
We've had other studies, and in fact, are getting ready to embark on probably what will be one of our largest studies, and that is a trial to really, in a community, study what we can do to intervene and improve the trend that we're seeing today in obesity, where, as both of you know, so many individuals in the United States, and particularly in the southeastern United States, are obese. The estimates from the CDC now are well above 30% of the population is obese. So,
you know,
lots of different things have been tried, and nobody really knows what works in the community. We know that there's a very small handful of medications that may be helpful, but it's mainly lifestyle interventions. It's mainly access to the right kinds of foods. So it's nutrition and it's exercise. And so together with Giselle's leadership and John Buse's leadership, who's very interested in this area, we're going to be rolling out a program that will look at a bunch of communities at least five different interventions to try to see if we can have an impact on obesity. And if you have a positive impact on obesity, then you have a positive impact on diabetes and on many other diseases, and on heart disease and hypertension. So we think that that's an exciting idea that really came to us back from the community. Not a big surprise, but so many people in the community saying that they were gaining weight and they had trouble controlling their weight.
Yeah, we're talking with Dr. Marshall Runge, Executive Dean at UNC School of Medicine and the Director of NC TRACS, North Carolina Translational Institute, to really bring research. And, you know, Dr. Runge, as you talk, I think about, you know, one of your major roles is dissemination. And in areas like obesity, we don't necessarily know the best ways necessarily to prevent it. But in other areas, we do have a lot of research, like my field of research, smoking cessation. We do know how to get people to quit. And how do we take what we know, and what can you all do to more rapidly infuse that knowledge into practice? Because it appears that there is a lot of knowledge that we know, but just giving people that information we know doesn't change their behavior. So how do you do that?
Well, Adam, you may have much better insight into this than I do, because you are an expert in that area. What I'll tell you is, when I became the leader of the NC TRACS Institute, in the past year, I've learned so much about different areas of research that I didn't know very much about. And as you know, there's an area of research called dissemination research. And UNC, between the School of Public Health and the School of Medicine and other health affairs campuses, is actually one of the leaders in dissemination research. So in trying to answer questions exactly like you posed about how do we have that positive impact and get people to embrace what we know will help them with smoking cessation or other chronic medical problems. So what I'd have to say is that I don't know the answer to that, but that's exactly the kind of, we love for people like you and others to bring these questions to us, to say, I have an idea on how to do something that will really have a positive impact for a community, and I'm going to write a grant proposal, and we have these grant funding opportunities for many for up to $50,000 and some up to $100,000 to put such a plan into place.
Well, you know, what's exciting about the work that you do, and you mentioned the School of Public Health, I know biostatistics, medicine, is it sounds like there's a renewed, or not renewed, maybe a new emphasis really on this interdisciplinary collaborative approach that involves everyone vertically and horizontally in ways that make people feel less competitive and more collaborative. And that to me seems to be part of what you're out there doing that's changing the culture of medicine internally and externally.
You said it better than I can. And we have, of the research grants that we have funded, they've come from over 15 different schools on the UNC campus. And many, if not all, are interdisciplinary research projects. And I do think that's become so important in research, just as it is in clinical medicine, to have multidisciplinary teams delivering medical care, not just a doctor or a nurse as it was 20, 25 years ago.
Absolutely. We would agree with that in many of our conversations. I have to say, Dr. Runge, I'm most impressed in hearing you talk about how huge of an undertaking this is. I mean, you're talking about, you know, a ton of money. I can't even fathom it. All these different projects and really trans. I mean, there's the statement of translating science into better human health. You're talking about defining metrics and outcomes and being able to defend this to the NIH. How do you frame your goals for the next few years, and how will you frame that to the NIH?
Well, we have some metrics that NIH wants us to respond to, and they want to know, have we been successful in bringing more clinical and translational research grants from NIH and other federal sources and industry sources to North Carolina to take on projects? And so what they're really asking is, in these pilot programs that I've talked about, have those had an outcome? And they have. So we have funded, in total, over 1,000 investigators who've now brought back to UNC over $200 million in NIH funding. And in projects that were funded by the Trax Institute, have published over 200 publications in excellent medical and research journals. So on that metric, I think we're doing very well. And we recently had a full review of our program by an external advisory board. And they think that we're being very effective at that level. What we need to be able to show, though, is that we're really having an impact on the community, and that's much more difficult. And so I think we'll be doing that not in looking at specific metrics, but more in description of programs and in follow-up of those programs, like the farming program that I told you about, or the colon cancer screening program. Or we have another interesting project is Carol Odie, who's a professor in molecular physiology, has an idea about how to develop a biomarker for pancreatic cancer. And pancreatic cancer is not an uncommon cancer, and it's characterized, as you both know, by showing up. By the time a patient comes with pancreatic cancer, often it's far too late to have much of an impact with chemotherapy or radiation therapy. So if we could screen and identify patients at a much earlier stage, that would be to the good of those patients.
Yeah, you know, we actually had Dr. Odie on our show recently.
Oh,
and
did you really?
We did.
Yeah,
it's really good.
And because we read about her work and we said, wow, this is cross-cutting, taking this work on this protein palladin to new levels. And she talked about her collaboration. We didn't realize at the time that this was supported by NC Track. So this comes full circle for us, maybe for our listeners, to understand how different pieces are connected here. You know, we're going to need to wrap up for our listeners. We'll have a little bit more of our interview with Dr. Runge on our website. You can listen to it. But thank you, Dr. Runge, for really engaging with us as you seek to engage NC Tracks for the people of North Carolina. We appreciate the work that you do and all of those who are really trying to make a difference in people's health.
Well, thank you both for this opportunity. It's been great to have a chance to reach out to people who may not know anything about NC Tracks. And I would encourage you, if this has triggered an idea, to please get in touch with us. We have a website, and through the website, or we have phone numbers, we have a group of individuals who will put you in touch with the right person who can tell you what you need to know. And if you have an idea for a pilot grant or you have an idea of a community project, we'd love to partner with you. So I hope we'll hear from you.
You'll find it at tracts.unc.edu. Thank you, Dr. Runge.
Thank you.
Coming up on House Calls, we'll be answering questions about your health. You're listening to Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page. Stay with us.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page on News Talk 1360 WCHL, sponsored by UNC Family Medicine. And now, more of Your Health.
Welcome back to Your Health. For the House Call segment of our show today, Adam and I are going to spend a few minutes talking about your health questions and concerns. What do we have, Adam?
Well, we've had some questions that have come into us from listeners about Weight Watchers, and we have questions about special types of sunscreens and darkly pigmented individuals. And we also had some experiences that people have had in the doctor's room and waiting offices as they wanted to share. And finally, Christy, we have a listener who sent us a picture about something pretty gross, and it's called a tonsil stone, and they wanted to know what causes it and what to do about it.
All right, we've got some good ones. Let's get started. What's the first house call we have today?
I don't have a question, but I did Weight Watchers and lost 18 pounds, and I think everyone should do it.
Well, this is a really good question. First off, congratulations. I mean, losing a weight is never easy, and you were successful, and so we say congratulations for that initial substantive weight loss.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing it with us. Sometimes people don't just tell us about the good news, and it's great to hear. So congratulations, and I'm a fan of Weight Watchers. I've been doing it for many, many years, and I think part of the reason it works, and lots of other diets can work too, but that it's more about changing your lifestyle and thinking about food and portion control over a long term, as well as exercise, and less about some fad crash diet that you can't sustain. And so I'm happy that it's worked for you and really appreciate you sharing.
You know, and my only caution out there for lots of folks is that if it is just a diet that you're doing, the thing that really determines whether or not you really successfully continue to keep the weight off for the long term is your adherence to diet, which is really adherence to a different lifestyle. So if it's just the diet that you've done, it probably will be successful in the short term, but not the long term. Mm-hmm. Versus just, I agree so much with you, Christy, if it's the lifestyle that you've embraced, then it's no longer really a fad or a diet, it's a different lifestyle.
Exactly.
So that's a great start. We wish you continued success. And for everyone out there, maybe we'll put up on our website a couple really good links to data about common diets so that you can have more information at your disposal.
Okay, let's listen to what we have next.
Hello, my name is Anthony. I'm a pre-medical student, and I don't think people understand it is a long wait for the doctor's office. Sometimes you have to wait around in a waiting room for 30 minutes to an hour, but I don't think people realize how much else is going on in sort of the mechanics of how a clinic works, and I think that would be a great thing for people to understand.
Well, thank you, Anthony. It sounds like you are maybe a medical student, and you've wanted to share with us your thoughts about people's experiences in waiting rooms, and sounds like that maybe you think people don't really understand the length of time and the complexity of the office environment. And what do you think about that, Christy?
Well, I think we have to be respectful of our patients' time and do everything we can to run on time. But I also do think it's important for patients to realize that when, you know, if someone has a crisis or an emergency or really needs our full attention, that we will give it to that person. And it might mean the next person has to wait a little longer, but when I get to that next person, I'm going to give them my full attention as well. Or if they know that when they have an emergency, that we'll take the time needed for them. It's really complicated because you want to be respectful, but yet there are a lot of pressures.
Yeah, and I also think that we sometimes don't demand enough of our systems. Now, mm-hmm. Not meaning us and UNC Family Medicine, because I think we really continuously total quality improvement, we're continuously striving to improve. But if you look at some things that, like the when you go to the bank and they had the instant tellers and ways of getting you in, or your bank cards to get money that you needed, and even checking in at the airport, getting you through that process quicker and more efficiently, you know, the automation has certainly helped. And I don't know if we've totally embraced the technology that allows people to move in and out of their medical environments as efficiently as we can, but I know we're trying.
We are trying, and we've gotten a lot better. If you look at the average wait times at the Family Medicine Center, they're actually very low. It's really impressive.
And we count when people check in, and we count when you actually leave, because we want to know that entire through time. We don't want it to be an hour and a half. We want it to be 30 minutes, if that's all you need.
But, you know, it only takes one time of waiting a really long time and having it mess up your whole day to really make you angry. I've been waiting as a patient that long, and it's really hard to be a patient waiting.
Maybe we need something like when you check in, we know, is it on time?
Yeah.
Is your doctor running on time? Is the flight on time? And if it's running 20 minutes late when you check in, you can make some decisions, because you might decide that that's not going to work for you. But who knows? I'm not that's tongue in cheek, but the idea is one that I support.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you, Anthony, for the question and drawing attention to it. Certainly, we need more work in this area. What do we have next?
I was just wondering what is the best type of sunscreen for African Americans. I saw a show on the news and they didn't really specify, so I didn't know if you could use the same sunscreen. So that's my question.
Well, I think the short answer is, do African Americans need to use special sunscreens? I would say no. There is not a special sunscreen, but the important point here, and I think you're alluding to it as a listener, and thank you so much, is that regardless of the pigment of your skin, you can burn and you will burn with prolonged exposure without any covering.
It's also good to know that African Americans can get skin cancer, and sometimes we don't pick it up until later because you have darker skin or because you may not be watching as closely as someone with fair skin. Hard to know why, but you need to protect your skin just like anyone else. And the SPF on the sunscreen should be at least 30, and you should still wear long sleeves and a hat and stay in the shade and protect yourself just like other people.
A couple small tips. If you have darkly pigmented skin, you might want to avoid skin products with zinc or titanium oxide. These are those white, thick paste things that will be incredibly noticeable and cosmetically probably unacceptable. And even certain lotions and creams versus maybe less cosmetically acceptable than some of the gels that will evaporate quickly. The importance is that you use the products, like Christy said, and maybe apply it more than once if you're going to be out in the sun for any prolonged length of time.
And make sure it protects against both UVA and UVB radiation.
Excellent. Well, let's go to our very last house call today. And Christy, this is one that's a picture. We're going to put it up on our website. But it comes from a listener who says that she just, she's in college, and she's been getting these recurrent, what she calls tonsil stones. And she wants to know what are they and what can she do about them, but she hates them, and she finds herself scraping them out of the back of her throat.
So these are stones that people can get in their tonsils, and when you scrape them out, they smell really bad. They're filled with bacteria that are pretty smelly, and apparently about 3% of folks who go to a doctor due to bad breath, have it related to these stones. So a small percent, but still some. And supposedly 7% of all people get these stones, get one eventually.
Yeah, so the medical term for them is tonsillolith.
Tonsillolith.
I think we can agree with our listener that we'll call them tonsil stones. And all that debris that accumulates in the back of the throat, or even sometimes the top of the throat, calcifies. And so, yeah, they are really calcium stones, and not like the type in your kidney, of course. And it's important that these things perhaps can be treated, and you can avoid maybe the bad breath. And, of course, make sure that it's not something worse, like a cancer or some sort of infection. But, they're pretty easy, I think, to diagnose.
Yeah, well, and I think once you know what it is, you can go and talk to the doctor about it. There are different treatments you can do to try to do a laser on some of those crypts, or some people might even try to get their tonsils out. But you would want to talk to the doctor and explore that a little bit because it's pretty, as things go, it's pretty minor.
You can get a low-cost irrigator and just very gently irrigate and flush out that area to prevent that stuff from building up. And just like you might do irrigators in your teeth to help out your gums, this could irrigate your tonsils to prevent it. So we're going to put a picture up there. That we thank you for sending that picture for us. And if you have other pictures of skin or other conditions that you want us to see, if you can email those. How would they email them to us, Christy?
You can email yourhealth@unc.edu. You can also go to our website at yourhealthradio.org, and there's their ability there to share a question.
Great. Well, that is going to conclude our house calls today. We've had a chance to talk about tonsil stones and Weight Watchers.
We've talked about using sunscreen no matter what color your skin is.
And we've had a chance to really have a conversation about applying principles of quality improvement to cut down on people's wait time at doctors. So thank you so much for all the questions that you sent to us and for sharing with us your opinions.
And thank you to all of you for joining us today for Your Health. We hope that we've had a chance to address some issues and concerns that are important to you and to your health, and we want you to write us. Again, it's yourhealth@unc.edu, yourhealthradio.org.
We'd like to thank WCHL, UNC Family Medicine, UNC Healthcare for their sponsorship, our guest today, Dr. Marshall Runge, and we hope you'll join us next week for Your Health.
On behalf of Your Health, I'm Dr. Christy Page.
And I'm Dr. Adam Goldstein. See you next week.
The purpose of Your Health Radio is to educate listeners on healthcare issues. Listeners should always discuss their own health or medical concerns with their personal physician or other healthcare provider. Your Health is not a substitute for medical advice, diagnosis, or treatment.
Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page has been brought to you by UNC Family Medicine for the Chapel Hill Carborough community. You can hear Your Health on Saturdays at 9 a.m., Sundays at 9 and 5, and Mondays at 6 and 10 p.m. Your Health with Dr. Adam Goldstein and Dr. Christy Page, a presentation of UNC Family Medicine and News Talk 1360, WCHL.